We don't need to raise every last dollar that we possibly can. We have a fairly broad mandate within the construct of our series of private equity funds. We don't have an ambition to start a core fund or a debt fund or you name it right now. If we deliver for our investors on what we're expected to do at the size that we are at, it is very good for them and is very good for the home team. And so we try to take a very long-term nature on how we do that. So we've been fairly thoughtful on how we have grown the business and continue to. Our view is you raise a fund that is appropriate for your investment strategy, not as much as you can get. It's a similar principle to the fact that you should take as much leverage as is appropriate for an asset, not as much as you can get.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Seth Singerman, President and Managing Partner of Singerman Real Estate, a Chicago-based opportunistic real estate investment management firm with $5 billion of assets under management. On today's episode, we discuss Seth's journey into real estate, why staying smaller and nimble by design is a winning strategy, and Seth's approach to investing and finding dislocations in the market. I always enjoy my conversations with Seth, and I'm excited to be able to share this one with all of you. Let's get into it. Seth, welcome to the show.
Brad, it's great to be here. I have listened to your podcast several times. You've had a lot of talented people on it, and you guys truly do a great job.
Love to hear it. Well, for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with who you are and your company, can you start by introducing yourself and your firm, please?
Happy to, but I'd also say, and I promise Brandon didn't tell me to say this, but we were one of his first institutional managers at Juniper Square, and it's been a good relationship. You know, who we are. We are a Chicago-based opportunistic real estate investment firm. We invest primarily through buying assets. Sometimes we'll do loans or structure investments. We have just under $5 billion of assets, and we really seek relative value across asset classes. So we're truly diversified with no asset class more than 25% of what we've historically invested.
So before you started Singerman, how did you get into commercial real estate? I always like to start all my conversations with kind of the story behind the story. You know, most people didn't wake up one day and decide the thing I want to do when I grow up is be a real estate investment manager, but maybe you did. So kind of talk to us a little bit about kind of where you grew up and what that was like, and then your kind of journey into commercial real estate.
So, you know, first of all, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I have the affliction of being a diehard Cleveland sports fan. I did not grow up in a real estate family. I actually grew up in a family of doctors. But I do feel truly lucky because at a young age, I did know I wanted to go into real estate. As many doctors do, my father traveled to a lot of conferences, and we were fortunate he took us with him on many of them. And so we got to see a lot of different cities and hotels, which I always found interesting. And so as I was growing up, I had two real loves. Growing up in Cleveland, it was football, and then real estate. And so even, you know, when I was at a very young age, I knew it was a path that I was considering.
When you were staying in these hotels, what was it that attracted you about kind of the hotel or the real estate? Like what was going through your head, if you can remember that far back?
It's so tangible. So it's a component of both, you know, these, you know, interesting assets and these interesting locations. Everything is different. And it's also the people, you know, the hospitality aspect to it in hotels. And so the exposure to seeing that was fun. And this one I have not shared. So, you know, new to Juniper Square, some crazy reason, at 10 years old, I actually wrote a business plan to build a hotel company. And so it was just something that I was always interested in. And I was fortunate to follow my real estate interest and go to the Cornell Hotel School, where I was a real estate and finance major. And I know you had Warren on the podcast a little while ago. He was a friend and classmate of mine. And it's really an example of the amazing relationships that I was able to develop at Cornell, many of which, you know, I clearly still retain to this day.
So you're one of the few who pursued your passion from 10 years old. If I would have executed my business plan at 10, I think I would have been an oceanographer, I don't know, something very unrelated to what I'm doing today. 10 years old, I mean, I can't quite fathom what inspired you to do that. And How did that translate into Cornell? I mean, obviously you had this passion, but there's a lot of time between 10 years old and 18 years old to kind of further develop, but you seem to have this kind of continuous vision.
You know, I think one was the travel and being able to travel at a young age. Another, I'd say, was there's some families that I saw in real estate. I'll give you an example of one. It's the Ratner family based in Cleveland. They built a company called Forest City, which was one of the largest diversified real estate families or companies in the country. And they did it in New York, and they did it in Cambridge, and they did it on the West Coast in San Francisco and a lot of different places. And they were really doing things at a high level, and they were really good people. And I had some exposure there. Even in high school, I had an opportunity to work the front desk at a hotel in downtown Cleveland, and it gave me kind of a love for the space. Again, there's a lot of very talented people out there, and the fact that I knew one of the paths that I loved was, I do feel very fortunate.
It's amazing. So you went to Cornell, you graduated, and then before you started Singerman, kind of what were you doing to start your professional journey into real estate?
Sure. So even in college, I had a couple of paths that I think really helped me. I took a semester off of college and worked on the IPO of a REIT called LaSalle Hotel Properties. And it couldn't be any more cliche. My desk was literally the storeroom. So if people came and they needed a pen or paper, I was their guy. And things go full circle because the CEO and head of asset management for LaSalle, which was, you know, been taken private a few years ago, they're now our partners on a deal that we acquired actually this year. So that's kind of fun. But I had a chance to do that. And then I also had a chance to work for Barry Sternlicht and Starwood as an intern while I was in college, right when they were acquiring Sheraton Hotels to merge it with Westin to create what's now Starwood Hotels. And I remember meeting Barry for an interview. Again, I was in college in a conference room when he was signing the documents to sell what was called the Desert Inn, which now sits where the Wynn Hotel is in Las Vegas. And so I was kind of fortunate while I was in college that I probably had some opportunities. And then right as I was getting into my senior year, I actually had a choice. I think I shared with you, I had two loves at a young age, football and real estate. And I actually had a chance to work for the NFL in their corporate office coming out of school. There was a guy who was a liaison between the owners and kind of the bigwigs at there who gave me a job offer. His now name is Roger Goodell. But I wasn't independently wealthy. And as I mentioned, I had a love for both real estate and football. And I figured real estate was going to be the more profitable path. And so what I did was, sitting in Ithaca, New York was clearly the more logical path for me. But being a Midwesterner, I figured I was going to kind of work my butt off wherever it was, and that Chicago potentially would be a better quality of life. And so there was a firm called Walton Street at the time, who was one of the larger private equity funds, and they're good friends to this day. And they recruited at several other universities. They did not recruit at Cornell, where I was attending. But in an opportunistic fashion, I wiggled my way into a final interview with them. Or they did their final day with a bunch of candidates. And so knowing that I was going to Chicago, I wanted to line up a couple of other meetings. And I got lined up with an interview with a group called GEM, who was much smaller than Walton Street. What I didn't know was that they were both offshoots of a company called JMB, which was once the largest private real estate company probably in the country. Both Barry Sternlicht and John Schreiber, who founded Blackstone's real estate, came from there. But what the most interesting thing was, Walton Street and GEM shared office space. So I literally had interviews with two different companies the same day in the same office space. And it was a little awkward. I ultimately went to GEM, and many of the team at Walton are good friends. And I went there because at the time, there was only six of us, and I was the youngest by 10 years. We didn't have a private equity fund. We were backed by who was the Malkin family, who was the M and JMB. And, you know, what it did was give me an opportunity to, you know, be part of growing a business and help build both a series of real estate private equity funds and real estate securities fund. And, you know, ultimately was the only non-founder to have kind of senior investment responsibilities for both those businesses, the public real estate investment and the private real estate investment. And, you know, was made a partner at a young age.
That's fascinating. It never ceases to amaze me how interconnected the real estate industry is and how a few of these core platforms like JMB have seeded so many other emerging and institutional managers. So I love to hear that connection. So you were at JMB and you had a pretty good run there. You were there for what, about a decade? Is that right?
A little over a decade.
And then you made the leap to kind of start your own venture. What was that? I'm sure there's a lot we can talk about at JEM, but kind of what drove you to want to go out on your own?
So, you know, it's interesting. I'll say, you know, as is the case with many firms, as they go through kind of their maturation process, they can have some changes to their investment perspective and objectives of the founders. And I actually never sought out to start my own firm. That wasn't a goal. My love is investing. And I wanted to have an opportunity or a construct to allow me to do that and control my own destiny. So the output to that was, you know, starting my own firm. And I had some, I guess, background, which was my father, again, I think I mentioned, was a doctor. He is an ophthalmologist in Cleveland. He started his own practice and ended up building out 13 offices around Northeast Ohio. Very different business. But what it showed me was the ability to take a risk and kind of control my own path and then take the good from which I had learned in my decade plus at JEM, and there was a lot. And then there was many areas that I also wanted to improve and enhance. And that's, you know, that's really was the foundation or kind of creation of Singerman Real Estate.
And so you started Singerman Real Estate in 2009, is that right?
Really 2010. I was on a extended gardening leave for a short period of time, which in many ways had some positives. It was when my first child was born, so I got to spend time there. But it also allowed me to think about what we wanted to do with this new platform and also allowed me to think about building the team. And so both of those things allowed us to really hit the ground running more than I could have otherwise, you know, during that time. So we really started in 2010 or late 2010 at the time.
So let's transition to talk about Singerman for, you know, our listeners who aren't familiar. You kind of gave a very high level framing when we started, but, you know, one of the things that is defining, at least in my mind, about your firm is your opportunistic focus. But maybe give us kind of the headline, you know, the size, the scale, kind of anything that you're able to share publicly here about the organization, and then we can unpack your kind of investing approach.
Sure. You know, so again, as I led, you know, we are a diversified fund. I think our investors give us the latitude, and with it comes a great responsibility to invest across asset classes, to invest across geographies in the US, and at times to invest across the capital structure. And so with that latitude comes responsibility. And we have to find that relative value and pivot across cycles and across opportunity sets. We do that at a scale that I would say for some is middle market, right? We are not a mega cap in the likes of a Blackstone or a KKR or a TPG, what have you. You know, our average investment sizes generally range from $15 million equity checks on the low end to, let's call it, you know, our sweet spot is that $15 million to $50 million range. We've done deals much larger where we bring in co-investment optionality, and occasionally we'll do some deals that are smaller. But that kind of subset is generally bigger than the typical high net worths, except in markets, let's say, like New York. And it's generally smaller than some of those larger opportunity funds. And that's a place that we are very comfortable sitting and finding dislocations.
How have you, I don't know if temptation is the right word, but in this current market environment, especially starting when you did in 2010, it seems, at least from my perspective, that there's been a race to aggregate or accumulate AUM, right? You know, how much can we raise? How much can we manage? Obviously, you get to collect fees off of that. That's not the core goal, but that's a derivative of what investment managers do to support the operations of their business. And it seems that you've been very consistent and steady in terms of how you've scaled the business. How do you think about this temptation to kind of grow very quickly and aggregate lots of AUM versus stay mid-market? And, you know, do you think that'll be the path that you continue to go down, or do you expect to change strategies going forward?
Sure. It's a great question. I think kind of talking about my roots and the roots of the firm help answer that question, which is, again, I'm lucky what I do. I want to be doing this for the next 20, 30 years. And so we don't need to raise every last dollar that we possibly can. We have a fairly broad mandate within the construct of our series of private equity funds. We don't have an ambition to start a core fund or a debt fund or you name it right now. If we deliver for our investors on what we're expected to do at the size that we are at, it is very good for them and is very good for the home team. And so we try to take a very long-term nature on how we do that. So we've been fairly thoughtful on how we have grown the business and continue to. Our view is you raise a fund that is appropriate for your investment strategy, not as much as you can get. It's a similar principle to the fact that you should take as much leverage as is appropriate for an asset, not as much as you can get.
Yeah, and I can see how that would have benefited you through this last cycle. So in terms of the scale, the size of the firm, approximately how many colleagues do you have?
So we have about 25 people at the firm. And a key to it, because you touched on it, that we are diversified. And to give you a sense, there's no asset class that's more than 25% or so of our historical investments. But with that, I think we recognize that everybody can't be great at everything, right? And whether it's sectors or markets, et cetera. So we've really, when we started the firm, we were not a lift out of another organization. We really tried to build the team organically with complementary skill sets. And so we've done that. We've had great continuity. The senior team has been together really effectively since inception. And we've been able to develop those complementary skill sets. And we've been able to attract people from really great firms, the Goldman Sachs of the world, the Blackstones of the world, the Tishmans of the world, who, you know, our team members come in and they share the same vision that we do in terms of core values, but also in terms of investment approach and our focus on kind of that measured growth and emphasis on, you know, delivering on returns over raising whatever three new different type of investment strategies.
I think that's a really interesting point. And, you know, I hear when I talk to executives, I hear a lot about attracting and retaining talent because it's so core to what our business is. And yet, you know, you just mentioned that you've been able to do so from some of these top tracked and retain talent from some of the top quality firms. What do you think it is that is of interest to them to work at Singerman? Why are they joining you, and kind of how is that different than what they might get at a much larger shop? Because I think what the perception is and the reality are often very different. So it might be helpful to unpack that a little bit.
Sure. I can tell you unequivocally, it is not my charm. What it, I think, is they recognize and appreciate that you can be very good, and ultimately, you know, they want to generate an opportunity for them to advance and to have, you know, positive economics provide, et cetera, and that there is very good paths to do that at medium-sized firms and large firms. And so at a firm like ours that is our size and diversified, people get a lot of exposure to different, again, asset classes, markets, parts of the capital structure, and is doing it at a high level, right? We're taking the institutional expertise, we're applying it to the subset of kind of deal size that we're talking about. We're not just kind of taking down large portfolios, et cetera. That dynamic seems attractive to people. And then, you know, I do think the culture aspect is very important. A saying that I've used many times is, you know, we have to deliver type A productivity without type A personality. And that's something that is extraordinarily important to me to kind of set the tone across the company.
So you've mentioned diversified a few times, and I know that your return profile is opportunistic. Are those two things definitionally synonymous, or how do you think about, you know, the asset classes that you can invest in and then the return expectations of your investors?
It's a great question. I don't think they're synonymous because I think you can be diversified as a core fund and you can find, let's say on the debt side, a very good risk-adjusted 10 IRR, right? And that may be a great risk-adjusted return. We can't do that. We sit in a more opportunistic construct, and that overlays everything that we have to do. What there is, though, is, you know, if we can invest across asset classes, whether it is, you know, hotels, it could be industrial, it could be apartments, life science, what have you, retail, it could be in different markets. But a common thread across those investments is kind of core investment principles. And so what we are, and there's great growth investors and there's good value investors. I'd say we skew more towards the value investing end, and we try to find asset level dislocations. So let me give you an example. An asset may do 80% of its competitive set. And whether it is for operational improvements, it could be it has a need of capital improvements, it could even be a change of use. We think we can get it to whatever the appropriate number is, 95, 100, 105% of that competitive set without assuming market growth or very little market growth. And if there is that market growth, then that's excess return. Because what we want to do is kind of control the returns at the asset level, not necessarily the market level. We don't want to have to predict that Raleigh apartment rents are going to grow by 5% or Dallas industrial rents are going to grow by X percent. What we want to do is kind of control our outcome at the asset level. And if there happens to be that growth, then that's kind of, you know, additional return from our side. That concept can be applied across asset classes and across markets.
So when I think about what that means in reality and how you structure your organization, you've got functional expertise in the form of people who understand real estate, underwriting, et cetera. But then you need subject matter expertise that enables, you know, you to underwrite a specific asset class in a specific, I guess the market's less relevant, but they're contextual. So, you know, from an acquisition standpoint, from a deal flow standpoint, how do you think about this, like, this dynamic or this tension between being an expert in everything versus being the best person to underwrite XYZ deal in ABC market, for example?
I think you're asking the classic question of, are you top down or bottoms up? And I'd say the answer is both, but which is not, you know, which can be possible. I'd say we spend about 15-20% of our time top down and majority of our time bottoms up, driven by a specific deal and the attributes of that deal. The toughest thing that we have is to determine where we spend our time. And because we have that breadth of opportunity set. And so we really vet that on a weekly basis. It is a opportunity, frankly, for analysts all the way up through senior partners to participate in that, where we determine where we want to do deep dives, whether that is thematically on something that we think may warrant more exposure or could potentially even be new, or actually at the asset specific level. Do we think that that's the right ROI on our time? That parsing of how we allocate our internal resources, I would say, is one of the most important things that we have to do as managers.
And so how do you think about allocating every, I mean, you just talked a little bit about it, but like when you hit the fork in the road, kind of what's that guidepost that says, yes, we should, or no, we shouldn't. How do you think about the decision-making criteria?
Sure. I think part of it is probabilities. And I think it was Bob Rubin at Goldman Sachs, who was, again, I believe the Treasury Secretary as well, who really emphasized this. But, you know, nothing in the investment universe is truly black and white. So you have to look at probabilities. And so look at an investment. Is it being marketed by JLL or CBRE? What's the probability of us really being the winner on that type of deal versus something where there may be more dislocated process? That could be a component. What is the ROI in our time? Is this a $15 million equity investment that we think has a reasonable probability of delivering a 1.5 multiple, 2 multiple, 2.5 times multiple? Ultimately, you know, we're taking in investors' capital. We need to generate kind of aggregate profits. There's a saying, you can't eat IRR. So we need to balance both IRR and profit multiples. So thinking about when, you know, kind of the spectrum of returns for a deal, what is the profit generation? So taking some of those different probabilities, probability of execution, probability of executing on the business plan, the time and energy that a deal may take internally. If you're buying a single tenant deal that has a 10-year lease to it, that's clearly a very different level of effort than the asset intensity of doing a major renovation of a hotel and repositioning. And so all those different things kind of go into the mix in terms of trying to determine where we generate that. And then the overarching thing above all that are those core investment principles that have to kind of flow through everything that we look at.
Yeah. You mentioned dislocation a few times. You mentioned dislocation just recently. You mentioned dislocation of the process. I think earlier you mentioned dislocation at the asset level. Are there other dislocations that you're looking for that kind of lead you to seek opportunities when you're going bottom up, I guess, if you're looking at kind of, you know, specific dislocations?
Sure. There's a couple that come to mind to answer your question. First, in the current environment, is capital structure. There is over $1 trillion of, you know, debt maturing over the next year and for the next several years. Asset values, and this is a very broad comment, are down 20%. Some asset classes more, some asset classes less. That leads to a gap in the capital structure. And it can manifest itself in several ways. One is for new acquisitions or developments, where a borrower may have been able to get 70-75% leverage previously. They can only get 55 or 60 now. And they may have a hole in that capital structure sitting between that 55 and 60, and let's call it 75%. It's possible, and we have in some situations been able to enter in there and get an opportunistic return. Again, the governor being an opportunistic return. An example of that recently is we committed capital to a development that also has a nearshoring trend to it in El Paso. And it was a very good sponsor. They, you know, had a first mortgage that was in that 55-60% range. They had a hole. We were able to go from, I believe it was 60-80% in the capital structure. They ultimately are selling the asset earlier than they anticipated because the market was good. The deal turned into a very good deal for us and an opportunistic return. We got paid off early, and a great deal for the sponsor who got, you know, their return in excess of what their underwriting was and faster than they got. That was an opportunity due to the dislocation in the capital structure. I think another opportunity that you're seeing is motivated sellers. And that creates that. So whether it is core funds today with their redemptions, fund life issues from some of the closed-end funds, lenders who do not want to take back assets but want to drive a marketed process and see where it clears, those are all things that can also create that from a sourcing process.
The motivated sellers one is interesting. And I think the first one, the capital structure. So, you know, the headlines, you mentioned asset values are down 20%, broad strokes. The headlines would lead you to believe that the market's either near the bottom, has bottomed, or is, you know, slightly just off the bottom. But regardless, it's off significantly from peak to trough. What's your view on kind of the level of distress? What are you seeing in terms of deal flow coming in? And, you know, are there any kind of trends that you can extrapolate, whether it's around a sector, a geography, or maybe one of these dislocations we just talked about?
Sure. So I'll give you some high level comments. Real estate values are off their bottom, I believe. But broadly, as I mentioned, values were down 20%. Industrial less, probably, you know, certainly office far in excess of that. We don't see deep distress in most asset classes. Office, clearly an exception, and some other subsectors of other asset classes. However, we do think that this is probably the most interesting investment environment, let's call it the last 10 years. And it's because of, one, the reset in basis due to that 20% decline. Two, those motivated sellers that I was just kind of articulating. And three, there's been a lack of development the last couple of years. And I think those three dynamics kind of create that interesting investment environment. And then if you then look across some of the sectors, I think there's pockets of opportunity in many different sectors, in most sectors, if you kind of go down. I'll pick on industrial, which is a darling right now. I think the ISM, the manufacturing data, came out today, and it was a little light. And not all of industrial is doing quite well. Its rent growth was very strong for a very long period of time. But some of the large distribution centers are tougher to fill right now. You're seeing some of these big bombers in some of these growth markets sitting there now. The Inland Empire rents are down off of extraordinary highs. And so there's some reversionary value, reversions there. But what we are seeing is, in particularly in the Southeast, that manufacturing trend. We're still seeing that nearshoring, onshoring. And we're seeing smaller tenants, let's call it, you know, buildings that are 200,000 square feet or smaller, the meat of the market of tenants that are 75,000 square feet. That is both very strong in terms of absorption and still in rental growth. And so that's just an example of an area that, you know, there is some softness in some places and there's strength in others. And you can run that through other asset classes. I'll just pick on one other for now, hospitality. The economy hotel segment and some of the leisure is kind of petering out. It was actually strong during COVID and the growth is slowing down. But the business transient and the group business actually is growing quite nicely right now. If you look at what Hilton, Marriott, and some of the big brands are, they're growing their group bookings year over year, double digit pace right now. So there can be exposure to some of those trends that I think are interesting. Lastly, you can overlay that on markets. There's some markets that are absolutely, you know, slowing down in hotels. And there's other markets, for example, Houston and Minneapolis are double digit rate growth this year, while San Francisco is still kind of struggling off of the bottom. And so there's the beauty of real estate, the beauty of what we do is there's lots of different ways to slice it and stratify it to find those pockets of opportunity.
So let's just take hospitality as an example, since it was the last thing you mentioned. If your top-down hypothesis or vision is that, you know, there's pockets of opportunity in hospitality, just from a practical, because I'm super curious about, like, how do you find these deals and how do you kind of get really smart on finding the needle in the haystack because of all these dislocations? So if you have a thesis that there's opportunity in hospitality right now, how might you instruct your teams to kind of pursue finding the right deals? And of course, I know that you're in the flow because you own, you know, you've been in the space for a long time, but what does that look like from a practical perspective?
Sure. So I think, let's just take hospitality is a big, broad sector, right? You could be buying Four Seasons on one end of the spectrum. You could be buying kind of the, you know, Roach Motel on the highway, another end of the spectrum. There's outdoor hospitality right now with glamping. There are lots of different ways that you can slice it. I think what we need to do is find, you know, a few areas that we think, getting back to probabilities, that we think have the right dynamics and the probability where we can find value and that dislocation. Today, a common theme that we see that we think we can apply is hotels eat capital. They are big consumers of capital with renovations. The brands mandate it. COVID hit. Then you had this capital markets dislocation. They're now mandating that you refresh those assets. And the cost to do that has risen as inflation has risen as well. And so we think there's a real opportunity to buy from some of those motivated sellers who have a fund life issue or don't have the capital to do that brand mandated renovation, where we can do that. And we don't have to assume any significant return on investment on those incremental renovation dollars, because we're buying it at a basis that is attractive enough and the cash flow attractive enough that we don't have to assume a meaningful ROI on those incremental dollars. That is something that I think we can apply across a lot of different hospitality assets today.
Interesting. Yeah. No, I appreciate you walking me through that. There's some parallels to the software world. I mean, there's a concept that was coined by Y Combinator called default alive. And for a venture-backed technology company, it's a state where if you assume the capital markets are frozen and your revenue growth is static, so you're not assuming massive revenue growth, can you get to profitability? If you can, you're default alive. And if you can't, you're default dead. And it seems like it's a similar principle here where you're holding your assumptions relatively constant in your underwriting, you know, the opportunity to grow the NOI at the asset level independent of the assumptions.
Absolutely. So, you know, we did that on an asset we acquired about a year and a half ago, where we did a significant renovation. We were assuming really no market growth. And we were in at a basis that we thought, you know, we could generate that return without a lot of return on that incremental capital.
Yeah, fascinating. So we're still talking about dislocation. One of the things I know as part of your kind of in your wheelhouse, if you will, is the ability to invest in public markets alongside your private investing. And I think you had mentioned you were responsible for doing that in your prior role as well at GEM. But what is that, you know, when you think about the public markets, either as an investment opportunity or as an indicator of what's happening in private market values and valuation, there's a lot of talk right now around, you know, discounts and undervaluation of the public markets relative to privates. How do you think about that as an investor in both sectors?
I think having, whether you invest in the public markets or not, as a private market investor, I think it's important to have an understanding of where they are, right? Public markets price every day. You know, private real estate values do not. So I do think that they can be a directional barometer of where things are going. It's not perfect, but I do think that that's the case. I also think if you look at the composition of the portfolios within public markets, it's a more of a proxy for core real estate than it is kind of opportunistic kind of value add real estate. But it is a good proxy for that. You know, the public markets, I think, have some interesting components. At very, very select times, we could invest in a public company, but we're going to only do that on a friendly basis. And it has to meet the opportunistic returns of our overall fund. So a hedge fund manager, for example, if they get a 20 IRR and a 1-2 multiple, so they made a 20 IRR over a year, they could be a hero. That is not our business. And so it is very select where there may be an opportunity for us. We are also sensitive to the fact that it's a non-control position, but you know, we've found a couple spots when there's been particular market dislocations that we are truly an expertise on, where we've been able to take advantage of that. The other thing that you see with the REITs is they like to be sellers or call the bottom kind of quartile of their portfolio. I call it, for lack of a better word, kind of asset quality snobs. And I mean that because the public market shareholders really put a high value on asset quality. That at times can create opportunities where you want to get a setup of a large motivated seller where, you know, every last dollar is less meaningful for them than kind of certainty of close. That can create a nice setup to buy from as well sometimes.
And are you seeing the public REITs as net sellers right now, or are they in acquisition mode? Because I know the corporate financing has been relatively cheap relative to what you can get in the private side based on the quality of their balance sheet. So how has that impacted the REITs and what does that mean for the availability of inventory either as buyers or sellers?
So, you know, they're doing a little bit of both for sure. And some sectors more than others. For example, right now, hospitality is trading at, I believe, over a 20% discount to private market values. It's tougher for them to be in deep acquisition mode. They should be in more sell mode, where they sell assets, buy back stocks. They're doing some of that, but I think in that example in hospitality, I think the private market may do that for them. I would not be surprised in the next 12 months if there's not one or two privatizations in the hospitality sector because it trades at a 20% plus discount to private market values. In other asset classes, that disconnect is less, for example, in industrial. And you're going to see a more balanced kind of buying and selling from some of those groups. They also, again, if they're more core-like, they don't want to deal with a lot of vacancy. Or so if there is an asset that has a year left on a lease with a single tenant that they know is going to leave, they may look to sell that and ultimately look to buy something that has a more core income stream to it.
All right. So I want to change gears and talk a little bit about your journey as an entrepreneur and a leader. One of the big themes in our industry right now is this idea of building businesses that have durability. And you've been, you know, at the helm and building Singerman for, you know, over a decade now, I guess, call it close to 15 years. I'm curious to know kind of what lessons have you learned as a CEO, founder of a real estate investment management company? And then we can kind of, I have a few other follow-up questions, but we'll start with that.
Sure. Well, it's been over a decade and it's been a lot of fun. And I just, you know, I hope I'm doing this for the next 30 years. You know, I use my father as an example. He's 81 and I mentioned he's an ophthalmologist. He's cut back. He is only seeing, I think, 100 patients a week now. And so I hope I have that energy. And that's kind of what we try to do. I think being kind of, you know, the CEO and founder, there's a lot of responsibility and a lot of things that go into actually running and kind of building the business. And I think the key to that is having good partners. My strength is on the investing side, and also fortunate to have developed some, you know, some good relationships with some of our LPs. But there's a lot more that goes into the business than that, whether it's executing the business plans on the assets we acquired, actually running the business, the management company. And I'm truly fortunate that I've got a lot of great partners. I'd say one thing that I was at least had some insight into was knowing my strengths and weaknesses and bringing in people that were very strong in some of those other areas. And they've been with us for a very long time. They're senior partners of the firm. And that has been, I think, a meaningful piece of the puzzle to, you know, to our success to date. I mean, the reality is you are only, you know, as good as the people that go up and down the elevator every day. And we're fortunate to have.
You mentioned a few interesting things, but I think one of the things that we were talking about before we started recording is some core principles that kind of guide the business. You know, how did you, you know, what are they? And then how did you go about determining that those were the right principles, and how have they served you over the last 15 years?
Sure. I mean, and I'll walk through, we actually had I am absolutely not going to win a Pulitzer Prize in writing, but in our first investor letter, I kind of wrote down four key principles, and they're still true to this day. That doesn't mean they're easy to live by and implement all the time, just as it's not easy to, you know, consume less calories than you burn, easier said than done. Same thing's true on these principles, but they stand the test of time. And so, you know, the first one was just alignment of interest. You know, I'm a believer in putting your money where your mouth is. You know, I put the majority of my net worth in our fund one when we started, and I still do that to this day as our funds have grown. I think another is really understanding real estate is cyclical and focusing on the downside first and principal protection. And I think, you know, clearly that 20% decline in real estate values that we've talked about that has occurred the last couple of years, that is reflective of that. And then we've been fortunate to, you know, to have actually grown our asset value during those past couple of years. So having that downside protection first and knowing the cyclicality is really important. You know, number three, I'd say is, you know, we're in the investment business. We've got to generate excellent returns. And, you know, what I look at, you know, you look at sports and athletes and everybody's bigger, faster, stronger than they were 20 years ago, right? We just had the Olympics. And I think one of the greatest Olympians of all time, Michael Phelps, I think every single one or almost every one of his records have now been broken. And the same is true in the investment business. There's a lot of talented firms out there and we need to continually improve and get better. And then that last four, you know, number four of those principles is a little bit what we were alluding to. People are important. And in this business, you know, relationships are everything. You know, I talked about the team and our team here at Singerman Real Estate. It's true with our investors. Many of them are not-for-profits, they're hospital systems, they're universities, they're other amazing institutions. And I remind our team often that this is who we work for. And then the other is our partners on real estate deals. You know, at times we have local partners or leasing teams or, you know, or great service providers like Juniper Square. And, you know, those relationships help us generate our value. And so, you know, relationships are so important. I have a niece who just started her career in real estate. She just graduated college. She's a first year analyst right now. And it's one of the things, we have a close relationship. I've really tried to really emphasize to her is even at a young age, developing those relationships because, you know, they hopefully pay dividends over time, both to you and to whomever you're developing the relationships with.
Yeah, I think relationships are essential. And that's a theme on almost every episode of The Distribution is the importance and the power of relationships. And it's certainly been a big part of how I've built my career. When you reflect back on the time so far building and growing Singerman, is there anything that surprises you in terms of things that your vision against the reality? I'm sure there's a lot, but from a business leadership perspective in particular versus, you know, an investment perspective?
It's a great question. I think once you transform from being an investor to an investment manager, I think that manager aspect is very important. You have lots of people. They're talented people. Everybody has a little bit different objectives. Some are could be first-year analysts. Some could be senior partners. I think learning those management skills and leadership skills and creating the right processes that can be enduring and leverage the talent of that team, that's something that I will tell you, I have a lot more appreciation today than, you know, the day that we opened the doors. I think it's really important and it's not easy. We certainly work at it, but being an investment manager and portfolio manager is different than being a pure investor. And I think some people that are looking to kind of, you know, hang up their first shingle, that's something to really think about as you go and try to construct a business for the long term.
Because I know that you're an investor at your core and you love investing. You mentioned that was your strength. I want to end on maybe an investment that you've done or evaluated that's very memorable to you that kind of embodies the kind of opportunistic nature of the investment opportunities that you're trying to take advantage of at Singerman Real Estate. Is there something that kind of comes to mind that you can kind of quickly talk us through to help us understand what it is that, you know, gets you out of bed every morning and gets your juices flowing?
Sure. I mean, the diversity of what we do, and I've used that word many times, it's different every day. That gets me going for sure. I think one example of something that I would say is the gift that keeps on giving for us goes back to our very first comments in the conversation, which was kind of my love for hotels when I was younger. And so there's a company called Extended Stay America. And, you know, when I was at my former shop, we actually bought into the stock of the company, and I kind of led those efforts because I led the hospitality side there for it. And ultimately, it was taken private. And it was a good result for the fund, good result for the firm, et cetera. They then, in classic form before the great financial crisis, put an enormous amount of debt on the company. So when the great financial crisis hit, there was an opportunity to buy into the CMBS bonds of the capital stack of that. And interestingly, the deal came from somebody that actually used to date my sister in high school, who was running the book for a big bank. And we were able to take this large bank out of their entire position in extended stay bonds. It was too big for us, so we split it with a very large private equity firm in New York that was familiar with the name. And that ultimately resulted in a good transaction. Then, as we started Singerman Real Estate, Extended Stay America owned all of their assets and this brand. And we went to them and we had an opportunity because we appreciated the business and we were able to buy a portfolio of assets from them directly. And they were going to try to create a franchise model. Instead of owning all 550 or so of their assets, they were going to sell some down to us and others and create a franchise model while owning some. So we own this portfolio of hotels. Now COVID comes and hits, and the stock gets absolutely clobbered like a lot of them do. But we sit there, we know what's going on with our 15 assets. These extended stay Americas, while they may be in San Francisco or they may be in Wichita, they're pretty homogenous. And so we had a sense of what was going on at the asset level, and we became a top five shareholder in the company, which was ultimately taken private again. And so that was, if you hang around long enough in this business, deals come back. That particular one came back in four different forms. There's one that's been good to us and an asset class that, you know, I've got sweet spot.
That's amazing. I love that. And that's a perfect way to wrap up because it talks about taking advantage of the dislocations and it talks about durability and longevity in your investing thesis and really not biting off more than you can chew, but benefiting from that focus. So I always enjoy our conversations. We could talk for many, many more hours, but unfortunately we're out of time for today. So thank you so much for joining me, sharing your perspective on your story and the business and the markets. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Brandon, I just appreciate the opportunity. And most importantly, it was really fun. So thanks.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.